Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 187 with the title, Healing at the Heart. And I have the absolute honor and privilege to welcome Jared Carroll. Jared is a personal development coach working at the intersection of social change and healing. He helps people understand who they are so they can show up more consciously, courageously, and sustainably in the world. When I asked Jared to describe his superpower, he said, it is bringing equanimity to difficult conversations so people can stay present, honest, and open instead of shutting down or fighting back. Hello, Jared. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Joe. Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Absolute pleasure. And we've been yakking away for probably 25 minutes and we had to press record quickly. Otherwise, everything we're talking about is going to end up on the floor and be lost for time. But we talked about the fact that you live in Oakland, California.
I do.
Yeah. And that gave us something in common because I was in Oakland a year and a half ago.
That's right. You said you were at HR West emceeing the conference. Yeah. I spoke at HR West, I think it was 2018, 2019. But yeah, right downtown Oakland, 10 minutes.
Same place? The Marriott Convention Center, was it?
Yeah, they have a big building there down, I think it's 11.
Massive, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, very cool.
And back at me, you're a football fan, UK soccer fan. So you follow the English Premiership, so you know about Portsmouth and where I come from because you follow the team.
I do. Maybe we'll get into this because it's part of my journey, but I was a college athlete, not soccer, but lacrosse. But I was a big sports guy in my youth and college and young adult. And then I decided I didn't want to be that guy anymore. But I kind of had one little thing I couldn't let go from my youth, which was soccer. So I decided, well, if I'm going to follow a sport, I'm just going to pick one country, and I chose England. So I know the British geography largely through where the soccer teams are. So.
That's a really really good way of doing it. And I know many Brits who follow American football or basketball or baseball, and they know all of the names of the clubs and where they are in the world.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess it's if you're going to learn geography, tie it to something, and why not sport?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, happy to be here and talk about whatever makes sense for us to talk about.
Well, let's start with the word that you put into your bio and show notes as equanimity. I struggled there. I struggled to pronounce it the first time because I've never used it before, and so I even had to feed it to Copilot to look up what it meant, but. You said that word has sat with you for a couple of decades. So why did you bring that into the conversation?
I bring it into all conversations about anything trivial or serious or anything in between. The way I define it, actually, I don't really have a concise, tidy definition like Copilot gave you, but I see it as a way for us, for me, for you, for anyone to... the hardships, the suffering, the challenges, the situations that we face just as, you know, being human with composure, with poise, with calmness, without freaking out, without getting too down or perpetuating a storyline that may or may not, often is not true. And then conversely, when, you know, the quote unquote good things happen, not getting too elated, not getting too high, not getting too cocky. And so just, it's this kind of ongoing self and meta awareness of what's going on and having the confidence to know I can handle it, even if I don't like it, even if it's hard, even if I don't know what to do or what to say, I can handle it. So as we both know, doing this type of work, those are important skills to have. And a lot of people do have them, but a lot of people don't.
And then in your superpower, you said it's about avoiding shutting down or fighting back. And when you are oppressed, marginalized, at the brunt of somebody else's bullying or discrimination, those are often the two choices, aren't they? Shut down, run away, tail between your legs, or come out with teeth showing and growling. And it's trying to sit somewhere in the middle there where you can engage in the conversation. And that's a really tough thing to do when you're under that psychological pressure.
It is. And I'm a, you know, I'm a cis, straight, white man. So I have, I'm at the top of the privilege food chain. So for, I think for a long time, I mean, I've been doing this work for 25 years. My father was a gay man. He died of AIDS in 2000. And that's when I decided to change, really, to do the work. And so when I started doing the work, it was the typical kind of social justice warrior, like, okay, time to wake up, Jared. You've been, you know, ignoring all this stuff for, you know, your whole life. And now it's time to not. So I jumped into that work. I was teaching at the time. That was my profession. And I was snarky. I was acerbic. I was dogmatic. I was, you know, things were new to me, new theories, new philosophies, new understandings of history that I hadn't really, I mean, I had some exposure to some of this through my dad, but I wasn't really listening that closely or, you know, it didn't affect me, I thought. So I'd say for the first, you know, 8 to 10 years, I was that, you know, newly woke white guy who was telling everyone how unwoke they were, until I decided that wasn't really effective or sustainable, which I'm sure we'll jump into many, many stories of how and why and how I shifted. But that's a good place to start with where I was back then.
Yeah. I think it is the temptation. When you're trying to educate people, you want to educate them by being right. Mm-hmm. And they want to be uneducated by being right themselves and not needing to be educated. It's trying to find that balance of how to educate without telling, isn't it? How to show, don't tell.
Yeah, it's which is interesting you bring that up because I was a teacher for 12 years. And for most of that time, I taught middle school humanities, you know, language arts, writing, history. I taught a social justice curriculum, so everything was through the lens of power and privilege, and you know, whether it was literature or history or current events or classroom dynamics, it was all through these lenses. And I was fortunate and intentional about finding a school that allowed me to, you know, not only allowed me, but that was what the school did and what they expected and supported us in doing. But to your point, yeah, we see that the world is unjust, is inequitable, is unfair historically and contemporarily on a micro and macro, on a local and global level, and we want change yesterday. And so we get upset when people don't see that as clearly or as quickly or as urgently as we do. And so that causes us to be more upset. Because if this person or this community or this, you know, this government only saw, and so then it becomes charged. And I'm not saying there isn't a place for charged or for protest or for other things, but which again, I'm sure we'll dive into more details, but I think we lose track of what we're actually trying to do. And we don't realize that we're actually not being effective in our, call it what you want to call it, fervor, righteousness, and I would argue that has contributed to the challenges that we in this industry, DEI, HR, social justice, whatever, however expansive or narrow we want to define that, as some of the challenges that we.
I think as I've matured, you know, I'm in my early 60s. How did that happen? You know, I think over the arc of your life, you go through different phases, don't you? And I think I've become to learn that even though I'm more settled in my ways, more relaxed, more calm, more pragmatic, more logical, always, I'm able to shift my thinking from my amygdala into my prefrontal cortex easier today. I don't get triggered I'm able to feed my human emotions differently. But I also recognize that in order to enact change, you need different people with different levels of passion, if you like, for want of a better way. You do need the people who are the angry social, not necessarily the mob, but the angry social justice warriors who are fighting for the cause, who are whipping up people who are in that same space as they are. But then you've got the people on the other side who are looking for political change, which is slow, methodical, nuanced, persuasive, lobbying, all those kind of things. And you've got people in the middle who are trying to do a bit of both and try and do it. I've come to realize that as I swing towards the more nuanced, logical approach, there's still a place for the people who want to, you know, wear the T-shirt, march, those sort of things.
Well, I think there's what I've learned is there are three perspectives to take in this work. There's the why, there's the what, and there's the how. So the why, I would imagine or hope or suspect that every person doing this work, social justice, DEI, change work, right, has a personal why. They may or may not have it be clear about it or really know it. Maybe they haven't done that work, but there's something that's driving them to do this work, right? Which is good. You need that, or else, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this, right? Then there's the what, which I think is what you were kind of getting at. Like, what is your role? So I'm a coach, I'm a facilitator. You know, some people might be, you know, a community organizer. Some people might be head of, you know, DEI at a big company, or, you know, whatever their, maybe you're a speaker. So there's the what. And then I was reminded as you were talking of, I don't have it super handy. Maybe after the show, we can put a link to it so people have it. But there's a woman named Deepa Iyer, and she has this, what does she call it? The social change ecosystem. And she talks about the different roles that are needed. And they, not all of us are and can be frontline protesters, rabble rousers. There need to be caretakers, educators, coaches, storytellers. I mean, and she has this whole kind of, you know, graphic that illustrates it very, very well. And that gets to the, for me, the why, the what, the how, I think is underappreciated and underemphasized. Because especially if you see someone like me who, as I said, you know, a little bit ago, comes from a privileged position doing this work, it's easy to dismiss my angle into this work as, well, of course you're privileged, so of course you can do that. But what about me who has, you know, XYZ marginalized identities? Which is fair. And taking this approach is open to anyone if they have the wisdom and maturity to see it. And so that's what I have come to emphasize and focus on in my work. And I can share some personal experiences that have led directly to that. But it's the how. How are we going about the work that is going to be effective and sustainable and build community, build connection? It's so easy to dismiss people who don't get it, who don't want to get it, who are hurtful, harmful, but the ways we've been going about it aren't working, and they're not going to bring about the change that we say we want.
As you're talking now, I think about some famous people in history that have probably themselves transitioned through those different ways of enacting change. You know, Nelson Mandela, for example. He was a freedom fighter terrorist. Prison probably calmed him down, but he came out a statesman of the nation, the grandfather of the nation, who then enacted change through political discourse, dialogue, calmness, and reason. Lech Wałęsa, who was instrumental in the fall down of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall coming down in the 80s, the Solidarity Movement. He was a freedom fighter. And we look at Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks. These people started off by in the protest, freedom fighters sort of space, and then transitioned into the reasonable politician or the logical response. I think that's probably a natural arc of evolution, I think.
Well, it is, and it can be, and I hate to use the word should, but I would argue that it would be beneficial on an individual and collective level if it was that arc. And you know, I don't think someone has to, you know, be in prison for 27 years to, you know, to come to that, not really a conclusion, but to come to that awareness, right? So how do all of us, you know, the people on the street doing this work, how do we come to those, that awareness ourselves without, you know, those big, dire, you know, historically relevant and known, you know, events in our life? Because we don't all have those, right? We have, you know, we have our own things. We have our own local things, our own personal things, our own, you know, but they're just as important. They're just as relevant. And so how do we individually decide, you know what, I'm not giving up on this work, but I'm going to do it differently so that it's more sustainable and more effective, and it's building what I want to see, not just taking down what I don't want to see. And there's all kinds, you know, there's so many people, you know, contemporary people who are doing this work. And I'm sure we'll get into some of them, but one who immediately comes to mind is actually, he lives in Oakland as well, Dr. Sean Ginwright. And he wrote a book, I think it's fairly recent, a couple years ago, maybe 2022 or so, called The Four Pivots. He, gist of the book is switching from trauma-informed work to healing-engaged. And so his first of the four pivots is from lens to mirror, right? So the lens is the world is inequitable, unjust, unfair. We need to change it. Here's what we're going to do. So it's not like that goes away or that's wrong, but the mirror is, okay, how do I need to change? What am I doing or not doing that's contributing to the chaos, to the, you know, to the status quo? And so he talks, and I follow his, you know, his newsletter, and he sends once or twice a week, he'll share a little video, and he's a, you know, he's a Black man. So that's just one small example of, this isn't just a privileged, you know, white guy thing. In fact, most of the people who I've been influenced by have been folks of color, queer folks of color, trans folks, people who are in multiple ways have experienced and still are experiencing marginalization, injustice, et cetera. And so I take, what's the word I want to look for? I guess I don't want to say like, oh, I'm glad they're experiencing that, because I'm not, but I'm glad that it's in so many examples of people who have chosen kind of what you were getting at with Nelson Mandela and others, have chosen to do their work differently, and are better for it, and the world is better for it.
Yeah. Again, as you're talking, my mind's racing ahead thinking, you touched a few buttons there, and I'm thinking in my own experience about 12, 15 years ago, I awoke, for one of it, you know, to paraphrase, lived same as you. I lived a life of privilege on the outside, benefited from that privilege. And then suddenly I stepped out of that lane into another lane, and it was a lot tougher, a lot harder, a lot more. And I think once I look back at that time, I definitely see myself transitioning through that awareness of what's going on in the world. Suddenly I'd lost a lot of privilege and gained a lot of marginalization, for want of a better way of describing it. And I think that then woke me up to the injustice in the world. And I think maybe when you say, you talked about people there, queer people, people of color, whatever it may be, is they've experienced this wind in their face all their lives, or they suddenly open the door and it's hit them. And you go, hang on a minute. Whereas if you never open that door, you never feel that wind, you never have that feeling of being marginalized.
Yeah.
It's really hard to build empathy with someone who has. You haven't got any reference point, have you?
Well, that's why, you know, people in our industry use the phrase, you know, do the work. It's ubiquitous, right? Do the work. Do your work. Do the work. We got to do the work. And we do. But I think sometimes do the work is implied too narrowly. I think when people, because I've had so many conversations, and either, you know, personal conversations or witnessed kind of conversations, or been part of, you know, online conversations where do the work means, you know, get woke. And they're talking to privileged folks. Do the work. you know, understand kind of what you were talking, understand why we're so upset, why Black folks are so upset about, you know, racism, why queer folks are so upset, why, et cetera. And that is necessary. And I don't disagree with that at all. Yes, do that work. And to me, do the work also includes just as equally. And if I was a good graphic designer, I'd have some fancy, you know, little graphic that would show this in maybe like a quadrant or, you know, something. It means do your inner work. Do your inner work. Do your healing work, whatever that looks like. For me, it's been Buddhist meditation, mindfulness, philosophy, right? The equanimity stuff that we started with. Doesn't have to be everyone's, you know, angle into it, but there has to be something that is healing. Or else, as I keep coming back to, it's the other work that you're doing isn't going to be effective or sustainable. So the other part of my story that, you know, I said my father, he was, so I was 14 and I was lived in San Diego, and my dad had moved to San Francisco. We'd been there, I think, since I was 11. So I'd go up and visit him, and it was kind of cool to come from the suburbs and go to the big city and ride the cable cars and, you know, all the fun, go to Haight Street and see all the hippies and, you know, all the San Francisco touristy things. So I was 14, end of my freshman year in high school, and he sat me down at the end of the weekend, and it was usually one of those, hey, I love you, Jared. I wish we could see each other more often. You're a good kid, you know, all those things, which he did do. And then he said, you know, something you should know, I'm gay. So I'm 14. This is the late 80s. We know what was going on in the world, especially in the United States. Reagan was still, I think, president, maybe for a little bit longer. So there's a huge stigma. So I didn't tell anyone. I went home. I cried. I went home and I didn't tell anyone for almost 6 years. I had the privilege of geographical separation. No one knew my dad. They knew he lived in San Francisco and I'd go up and see him 3, 4, 5 times a year. But I went through all the rest of high school and halfway through college without telling anyone because I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. I was confused. My dad and I had a decent relationship. But about halfway through college, I was a college athlete and I wasn't mature enough to have a gay dad, to own that, right? So he and his partner would visit, you know, every once in a while, and I'd have to arrange things or make up lies. And yeah, it's my dad and his friend, and we're just going out to lunch. And no, you know, we don't need to invite any of my friends, Dad. It's cool. Like that kind of, I don't know if I can swear on this podcast, but that kind of BS, right? So finally, summer of after my sophomore year, about halfway through college, I was with my friend Amy, and she was my best friend since high school. She went to school in Colorado and we were in the mountains camping. And I said, Amy, I got to tell you something. She's like, what's going on? You're being weird. I said, my dad's gay. She said, big fucking deal. So I was 20 years old. And that was the moment that I wouldn't say I changed all of a sudden and just like was this, you know, gay rights advocate. But that opened up like, oh, like this is a me thing. This is like a limiting belief that I have. So it started growing and growing a little bit. And then when I was 27, is when he passed. And so when he was HIV positive. And so I would go up and visit him. You know, I'm in my mid 20s now out of college, still living back in San Diego. And I'd go up to visit him and he started going to these gay men's meditation circles in DeBose Triangle. People know the city. It's right next to the Castro. It's like kind of a cute little neighborhood. And it'd be him with like three other men in their 40s and 50s and this woman who led it. And then me, this 26-year-old kid. And this woman would lead these like little, it was in this super huge, like open yoga studio with skylights and hardwood floor. It was beautiful. And she would lead us in these meditations, sitting. We do like walking. Chew, like eating, like all the stuff that I know now is like, you know, Buddhist stuff. But at the time, I hated it. It was physically uncomfortable. It was hard to sit still. But my dad, who was never religious or even spiritual, he knew he was going to die soon. And so he felt that he needed something to ground him. And so that's what he did. And I know now that I was lucky to be exposed to that. I probably went to those sessions maybe not even a half a dozen times, probably four times. And when he died, I decided, and it wasn't with the clarity that I have, but I decided that I would do the work that I described before to understand the injustices, but I would also do my personal work and develop equanimity, cultivate the healing for myself so that I could do the work more effectively. So that's the origins of the original origins. There are more recent stories that have deepened my appreciation and belief in the need for healing, but that was the original genesis of it.
When you said, your friend said, was it Amy, said, big deal, no big deal, no biggie, whatever, about your dad being gay. Completely resonate with that. As you were saying that, I was thinking, the only person it is technically a big deal for, and this is my own experience here, is your wife, your partner, your husband, or whatever it may be in that relationship. That's probably the only person who it's allowed to be a big deal for, because it is so intrinsically linked to that other person, that contract you have in a relationship. Whereas if you're a parent, a child, a brother, sister, friend, big deal. It's not, get over it. And my wife, it was a big deal for her. It was a big deal for her, be gender transitioning. Everybody else was inconvenienced by it. Everybody else was kind of having an opinion about it. But one person that it really mattered to was my wife. And we were able to work through it. But it is a big deal to her.
Well, it's interesting you share that, because that's a good segue to the next part of the story.
Go for it.
So what I've learned and come to understand about healing, this is a vast generalization, but I think it's helpful just for this conversation. Two things cultivate healing. Two areas of mindset: connection and letting go. I don't know how much time we'll have to get into the details of what all those look like, but generally letting go doesn't mean ignoring or dismissing. It just means being lighter, right? Understanding what's going on for ourselves, for the world, for the people we care about, and not carrying it so heavily and so often and so much, where it impacts your right. So where you're not equanimous, right? And connection, right? Connecting to other people, right? When we're doing this work, it can feel isolating, right? People don't get it. People aren't changing like I'd like them to, or as quickly as I'd like them to. Where are my people? Like all these things, right? And it's not just in social justice work, just in life. So it was it was sitting right here at this table. It's my dining room table. 12, 13 years ago, and my mom was visiting. I have twins. They're 16 as of this recording, so they were like 4. My mom was visiting, and we were sitting at this table. It was a Friday night, and we were playing cards, is what we do. I'd left teaching and I'd started a daddy blog probably like in 2010-11. So I had this blog for a couple of years, and it had some decent reach, and I was in some writing communities, and of course I was initially I was writing about my kids and kind of more satirical stuff about being the father of twins and how hard it was and everything. But then it started evolving. I started writing more about politics and my dad, and that was when I first started writing about my stories that I now very openly and easily share about some of what I've just shared and other stories. So my mom was a regular reader of the blog, but she was not a major character in any of the stories. So, and we talked about it a little bit, like she'd leave a comment and, we go, but it was very superficial and I kind of dismissed her. So we're sitting here playing cards, and out of nowhere, we weren't even talking about the blog. She just says, Jared, you write a lot about how your dad being gay influenced you in your politics, but you never write about how he wasn't around to raise you. Mike, it's like, oh my God. And I don't remember the rest of that conversation, I'm sure it didn't, it wasn't like, oh, you're right, Mom. Like, it wasn't, it was, I probably tried to go somewhere else. And, but I remember that night very clearly. And that was the beginning of, or maybe not the beginning, but another clear marker of like, that's right, connection. Here's my mom, who, she was 19 when she had me. Hippie in the 60s. My dad was gay. He knew he was gay, but you don't come out as gay in the United States or anywhere in 1970. So he meets this 17-year-old girl, right? Move off to college town, get married when she's 18. I'm born, you know, a year and a half later. And then 2 years later, my dad finally has the courage to say, hey, you know, this isn't working. And he does his own thing. So now my mom is 21 with a two-year-old with no education, no real skills, and raised me. And yes, we grew up poor and it was all the things and, you know, and saw my dad fairly regularly, but she's right. He wasn't around to raise me. And so I started to realize, and I know now, like that connection, right? Not just to my dad or to my mom, but connection to people and their stories and their realities that, you know, Brené Brown and others talk about this whole bullshit of like comparative suffering. Was it, you know, was my dad's life harder than my mom's? Yeah, probably, but who cares? Like they were both hard for, you know, for various reasons. And if we dismiss that, where are we? Right?
Well, what we end up doing is trading pain, isn't it? It's sort of,
yeah,
I've had it tougher than you have. And it's, we all go through stuff. We all have our stuff to deal with. And it's not about my life is tougher than yours. It's just, it's all relative. You know, it's you know, if you got $1 million in the bank and having a tough life because of something, it's a different experience than if you got $5 in the bank and you're having a tough life.
Yeah.
Your circumstances are all relative, aren't they?
Well, they are. And I think, and I try to be very mindful of not being dogmatic with my, you know, Buddhist beliefs, but it's been 26 years now, really, since I've kind of was introduced to some of these concepts of like equanimity and interconnectedness. And, but we're, I mean, it sounds almost cliche or trite, but like we're all interconnected. And so I'll give you an example. I reached out to you, I don't know how long ago, a month ago, not even a month ago, probably 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, on LinkedIn. Yeah.
On LinkedIn. Yeah. You know, I have this new coaching program that we're launching, which we can talk about in a little bit. And we've been connected for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, you know, like just like LinkedIn does, like we're connected, but I don't remember you and you probably didn't remember me. And so I reached out and said, hey, I know we've been connected for a while. And it was a template message, right? I know we've been connected for a while and here's this new thing and see if it resonates with you. So that's how you invited me to this podcast. Okay, great. That's a great result of the outreach. Well, similarly, I reached out to someone else who similarly, we'd been connected for 5 years, but had no idea who they were and said this message. And she responded, before I continue this conversation, please point me to your organization's publicly displayed stance on the genocide in Palestine. Fair enough. We don't have one. I don't have a publicly displayed stance on the genocide in Palestine. So what I maybe should have done is just said, we don't have one. Thank you for your time. You know, next. But I chose curiosity over boundaries. And I said, hey, totally get that. I am aware that there's a genocide in Palestine. I believe there is one. I'm against it. But I've chosen and I try to give some philosophy of my equanimity in my life and all the things. And, you know, she went total ridicule and mockery. And what's the argument when you attack some ad hominem attacks? It's my character, and then I continue the conversation because I'm like, okay, like she's, and it just kept devolving and it was really immature. So then I said, okay, hey, like obviously this isn't working. you know, she was making fun of the program that we were having. She was making fun of my outreach skill, you know, just anything she could do to belittle me. So I'm like, okay, I can handle that. Like, it's not about me, it's about her, but it still doesn't feel good. But it wasn't like, it didn't challenge my belief in what I was doing. But then I went and I had been trying to write a little bit more on LinkedIn just to, you know, kind of get some thought leadership out there. She went through about 6 or 8 posts and used the laughing emoji. So at that point I had to block her, which I don't like doing, but it was clear that she not only wasn't interested in what we had to offer, which is totally fine. That's how sales works. Like, not everyone's going to be like, yes, sign me up for your program. But then it went that. And so I was thinking like, a healed person doesn't do that. And what was the impact of that for her? I don't know. I'll never know, because obviously she's not going to have a conversation with me. I don't think she has a podcast and isn't going to invite me on if she does. So I share that as just a very recent example of what I've been seeing for years and years. And I would never have done that, what she did, but 15 years ago, I'd do that type of stuff. Maybe not as extreme, thinking that because the cause is just, that the behavior is acceptable. And it's not. So
I've been the brunt of other people's ad hominem attacks and laughing emojis on my posts. And you should look at my TikTok and my YouTube channel and all the comments on there. It's just, it's all personal attacks. There's no argument. It's just attacking me, my voice, how I look, how, all this kind of.
Yeah.
So,
And I mean, I don't need to tell you this, Joanne. Like, someone listening to this conversation right now might say, Jared, you're a straight man. Joanne is a trans woman. Like, who has it harder? But that's not the point. It's the whole master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. Is that the goal of, you know, marginalized, oppressed people to flip it so then they can? No, I don't think it is. Most of the people who I talk to, who I'm in relationship with, don't. That's not the goal. And A, that's not really possible. And B, it's not sustainable. And so it's the short-sightedness of it that, you know, it doesn't get us where we're trying. It's just colluding. It hasn't changed me. I mean, I told her and she chose not to believe me that, I mean, it's not that I disagree that there's a genocide in Palestine or that it's bad or that it's harmful or that it should stop. I agree with all that. And, you know, her mocking me doesn't make the genocide end.
And what it did was it shut down an opportunity for education, because I'd love to have a conversation with people about their perspective on what's happening. I've got friends on both sides of the equation who live in that region, and I hear different opinions. I've spent some time in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Bethlehem and places like that on work conferences and things, meeting the people. And I've got people in this country who have strong opinions on both sides. And my view is the death, the killing of the lives being ruined, the carpet bombing of property and the destruction of assets and wealth, completely abhorrent. But beyond who's right and wrong, we just stop it. And then we can work out how we get from where we are now to where we need to be, which is getting people back to life and getting things moving. Yeah. I think we have to unpack all of the why and the blame. We'll just spend all our time blaming each other and throwing more missiles, either words or things. We're not going to solve it. But we need to bury our prisoners of our beliefs and just say, hang on a minute, holding on to where we are now is not going to change anything.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, you used the word holding on. And as I said a little bit ago, what I've come to understand is two things lead to healing: letting go. So not letting go of fighting for justice, but letting go of the dogma, the us versus them, all the things, right? And then connection.
Wanted to be right. People want to be right, don't they?
Well, when you were summarizing kind of, you know, what I had shared, I thought of a phrase that I learned recently in a book called Cultish. I forget the author. But she was writing about just, yes, like actual cults like Manson and, you know, Jonestown and stuff, but all just the kind of the cultish mindset around things, even like marketing and everything. And she said, you know, when you know, a leader or a member of a group, and I would say, if you've read Woke Racism by John McWhorter, he talks about this, like the woke mob is kind of a cult. It's like this religion, right? Like either here's the right way to believe. And if you deviate from that, then you're going to be excommunicated is, you know, the extent of the analogy, right? But this author in Cultist, she introduced a phrase that I hadn't heard before called a thought terminating cliche.
Okay, cool.
So I don't know exactly what this woman who I was talking about, what she would have said that would exactly fit that as a thought terminating cliche, but the whole exchange was a thought terminating cliche. She wasn't interested in dialogue. She wasn't interested in nuance. She was interested in, I didn't meet her standards and that was not okay. And therefore I was eligible for mockery, ridicule, etc. So in the grand scheme of things, that's pretty minor. Like I have equanimity. I can handle it. I don't take it personally. But like that kind of nonsense happens all the time. And so I'm finding there seems to be a divide, maybe not a divide, a continuum, I think is a better word, of people who are somewhere on their awareness of what healing is and looks like and the need for it personally and as a society. From, let's take this woman, probably isn't interested in it at all. Although I don't really know because I'm not going to have that conversation with her. To people who like, yeah, like, one of my favorite thinkers and writers is Lama Rod Owens. He's a queer black man, and he's a you know, a lama, ordained Buddhist lama. And he's written a couple books. His first one was called Love and Rage, and it gets at exactly this dynamic. The world is messed up. It has been for a long time, and it's personally affected me as a gay black man. And I'm just going to self-destruct if I don't change. And so he did. He has. He is. And his new book, newish book, is called The New Saints. And he's like, how do we hold all of this complexity and nuance without self-destructing, without giving up or compromising our values, but also without self and self-destructing and causing more chaos, more destruction to others. So it's people like him who have lived it much more deeply than I have, who I'm learning from. And there are people out there who are toward that end of the continuum of understanding and appreciation and action. But there's still a lot of people who are the social justice warriors who think that the cause is just, so the behavior is just.
I mean, what you're trying to do is you're waterboarding people, really, aren't you? You're just pouring water and hoping, you know, drink this. Not allowing people to breathe. When you're that passionate, you think that everybody thinks like you, or you want everyone to think like you and be angry like you, and you've got all this baggage. And yes, it's important that people hear your story. What we're not trying to divide up between the what you believe and the why you believe it. This scenario you talk about here, you never had the opportunity to understand the why. Why are you so passionate about this topic? If you lost a loved one, if something happened, if your personal attack on you, is this why you're so angry, so fired up? You never got the point to build empathy. You just built, as you said at the beginning, shutting down or fighting back. She was fighting back. You were shutting down. There was no way of, yeah. I'm out. Goodbye. We're now asking these questions. We want to know what her passion was, why she had this, all that educational purpose has been lost because the disengagement happened.
Yeah. Well, to her, it was very clear as I'm processing it or translating it, I guess, right? Is there's a genocide. It's wrong. People need to fight for it, do whatever they can, even if it's small. You're not, meaning me, you're not, I don't see anything that demonstrates that you're, you know, at the level of understanding and agreement with me. So therefore, you are, and I learned this term recently, an unreal other.
Okay.
Which, okay. I mean, that's basically what historical oppression does to trans people, to gay people, to Black people, to poor people, to immigrants, to, right? They're unreal others. So
dehumanizing, yeah, basically.
Dehumanizing, yeah. Right? Because if you dehumanize, if she comes to this quick, you know, conclusion that I don't get it, don't care, ignoring, you know, basking in my privilege about the genocide in Palestine, then I'm an unreal other. Then I don't, there's no need to have empathy, curiosity, compassion for me because, you know, I don't deserve it, which is exactly what Israel's doing to Palestine. And count dozens, hundreds, thousands of examples from history that exactly the same type of thinking, right? And so we're just repeating, you know, we're colluding. There's a great book called The Anatomy of Peace by the Arbinger Institute. And the main thrust of it is when our heart is at war, as to use their language, which doesn't mean heart at war doesn't mean we're angry, we're upset, we're, you know, we're seeing that something that needs to change. It just means how are we processing that, those emotions. So if our heart's at war, whether it's an interpersonal conflict or a global conflict, there will never be resolution. Never. We're just colluding. And so that's where I've landed the last couple years is it's a clarity, Joanne. It's a clarity of like, I don't believe any less than I used to about the injustices in the world. But I also see more clearly about what's not working for me and for all of us. And I'm not going to be part of that collusion anymore. And I'm not.
So calling it in rather than calling it out, just be part of the educator rather than the stop sign.
That's a way to summarize it. I'd say to use that language, my calling in is doing the coaching that I do, right? Is who's ready? Who sees this even just a little bit? And knows that there's a better way, but for whatever reason hasn't gone that route yet. So that's where that's my version of calling in. Hey, I'm calling you in to do some deep inner work, some mirror work. You got the lens part pretty down. I trust that you understand the issues and you see why there's why there's problematic things going on and why they need to change. I'm not questioning until you show otherwise. I'm going to trust that you got that part down. What I am seeing very clearly is that you don't have the inner part going on. So if you're interested in that, because you can't, you know, this woman that I told the story, she's not going to be a coaching client of mine. Although, I mean, you know, She could be. She's a good candidate based on her behaviors. But you know, if you're not interested in going there, I mean, just like any coaching, like you're not gonna, you know, it's like kids taking piano. If they don't want to do it, they're not gonna do it. So,
yeah. I mean, as you pointed out, you know, you reached out to me with potentially the same message you reached out to her with. Clearly, it was a template. Clearly, it was a salesy kind of like,
yep.
Do you want to do my coaching program? Pay me $100 or whatever it was. You've got two choices at that point there. You can either get sort of like abusive talk, friend or disconnect or whatever it is. And depending on what mood I'm in, quite sometimes I'll just sit there and playfully say, not for me, but if you want to come and talk about my podcast, let's do it sort of thing. Yeah. And that's what I did. But
yeah. So here's, who was it? I can't remember who it was. It was someone you wouldn't think of, but there was this. So I'm also a certified purpose coach. So like 7-8 years ago, I got my purpose coaching certification. It's all about like leadership style and intrinsic motivation and kind of what motivates you to make impact and to do the things you do and stuff. So it's all integrated into all of this. But so purpose, right? This idea of purpose is like intrinsic motivation, meaning, authenticity. And there's, you know, all kinds of different angles one could go into, like, what is your purpose? But oftentimes people conflate purpose with passion. So the passion, you know, people, I don't like to use the word passion. I don't mind if other people do, but I don't personally use it. I don't consider myself a passionate person. If people want to, you know, describe me as that, that's fine. But this woman, this author, I can picture her doing this little mini TED talk, but I don't know who she is. She says, sometimes our passion, because we're so passionate and it gets so charged because we're so passionate about whatever it is we're passionate about, gets in the way of our purpose, so that our purpose, our true why, doesn't really actualize. So to me, that is a nice little encapsulation of like what healing means. How do you let go, which doesn't, again, doesn't mean ignore or, you know, kind of get rid of stuff you care about, but how do you let go of that passion so that your purpose can come through? And I think that's a lot of the work that I do is people see that conflation a little more clearly.
Yeah, but it's the ad hominem attacks. Technique I found that seems to work for me is a bit like in the Matrix where Neo's or like, and the bullet goes flying straight past. I kind of try and do that because the person who's attacking me doesn't know me. There's nothing about my values or anything like this. They're using this stereotypical persona of me. And I always think of it, it's just what they're doing is they're spraying graffiti on a wall.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very angry words on a wall. And I drive down the street and I see the graffiti on the wall. Okay, it makes me feel worried and threatened because it's there. But it's just graffiti. And all I've got to do is just keep driving and drive past it. So I'm doing that sort of neo bullet passes me. They're attacking me. And all they're really doing is spraying graffiti on a wall behind me. And it's not about me. It's about their anger about something. And it's not about me. So I'm able to... Yeah, you know, this equanimity you're talking about, being able to hold this space. I don't absorb it. I just go, whoa, yeah, okay, well, it's not me. You're talking about somebody else here, because if you knew me, you would not say that.
Exactly. And even that's a beautiful analogy with the metaphor I can picture, especially living in, you know, Oakland, San Francisco. There's lots of graffiti around. Mm-hmm. Some of it actually quite beautiful, but... You know, that's a whole nother conversation.
Straight art.
But exactly, there's another, I mean, I'm a big reader. If I was downstairs, you'd see my big library. But another book that has been fundamental, foundational for my belief system is the Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. And it's interesting when I bring up that book, either people go like, oh my gosh, I love that book. If they've heard of it, right? I love that book. Or they go, yeah, that's like pop spirituality. Which is totally fair. It's like, you know, 150 pages. But for me, the four agreements, the first agreement is don't take anything personally. I'm sorry. The second agreement is don't take anything personally. And in the book, he says nothing anybody ever does is because of you. It's always because of themselves. So that doesn't mean it's easy to take the... You know, but that's what we do. We know that foundationally and we process that. And maybe we need coaching or therapy or other sources of support. But if we know that that's not about us, and if we feel confident that we're acting in alignment with our values and in integrity, the more we practice that, the more we can see it clearly for what it is, right? I'm not a cause of the genocide in Palestine, no matter how much this woman wants to paint it as that. It's about her, right?
But collectively, we can all agree that it needs to stop. Whatever's going on needs to stop. And we as a world need to help people rebuild and press pause on what's going on at the moment, have conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah. And me putting a statement on my website won't do that, but I will speak up about my opinion in situations where it's relevant completely all the time.
Well, I'm inspired by, you brought up Nelson Mandela, like, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, who just died a few years ago, actually on my kid's birthday. I think it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. You know, he was a Vietnamese Buddhist monk who got exiled during the Vietnam War because he was speaking up, you know, and he wasn't safe. So he I can't remember if he ever eventually did go back or not, but basically he never got, you know, he didn't really get to ever go back to his country. And he continued his work. And he died, I think he was 95. So for 60 years, he was doing his, you know, what was his phrase that he used, like active Buddhism or something like that. So it was, you know, people think of Buddhism like, oh, go in a cave in the hills and meditate for 20 years. It's like, yeah, people do that. But the real purpose is to understand clearly so you can enact change in whatever ways you need to do. And in his case, you know, he was a writer, he was a speaker, he was training other people to, you know, to see things clearly. So this whole argument of like, oh, if you were really, really impacted by things, you would think differently. No, I don't buy into that as a kind of wholesale philosophy. Yes, are there people who are privileged and ignorant? Yes, of course. But, you know, that's not a default blanket statement that applies really for anything about anyone.
Is the world getting more polarized, or are we just seeing it through our current lens? You know, that social media, the mainstream media pushing people against each other, driving revenue from clicks and anger. And are we getting worse? Is this ever going to end? Or is it just a symptom of the times?
It's hard to, I mean, I'm not a scholar of, like, you know, journalistic and social media and media trends. But whenever I see someone or a report or an article or something kind of say, like, you know, times are worse now than they ever have been, I always wonder, like, is that true? Like, I mean, I don't know. So I don't know the answer to that, Joanne, you know, comparatively now versus then or, you know, another time. But I will say that it's the way we interact with each other, whether it's online, like on, I mean, I'm only on LinkedIn and even decreasingly these days as well, does contribute to everything we've been talking about. And not just the story that I've shared, you know, with this woman, that's an extreme example, but even just the little ways that we interact with each other or don't, the ways, and I'm sure if you asked 100 people to tell you about the LinkedIn algorithm, you'd get 100 different, you know, examples of why it's messed up and how we can't figure it out. So I'm the 100th. I don't know how it works, but I do believe it does reward provocative. And I used to be a much more frequent writer on LinkedIn 4, 5, 6 years ago. And I noticed, like, okay, I'm going to write a post. If I write it this way, it's going to go. If I write it this way, it's likely to get a lot of, and for the most part, I was right. And so, you know, did I contribute to what we're seeing? Yeah, probably. And that's part of the healing process, is I'm not going to do that anymore.
Which is more successful? 1 million views, hundreds of reactions and comments, or 5 views and someone takes action to the positive? Someone taking action is the objective. If it's just people clicking and getting torn up, that's not change. That's just outrage, isn't it?
It is. There's a phrase, is it like, there's like outrage bait or something like that?
Clickbait, outrage bait. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's just,
so
you're just fueling it, fueling the trolls, aren't you? You don't care.
Yeah. Well, and you know, at the heart of all this, Joanne, which is, I don't know if it's really an elephant or not, but it's capitalism. Like, we all have to make money, and LinkedIn is a social, you know, professional networking platform. And, you know, you got to try and, in whatever you're, whether it's direct through messages or writing posts, you're trying to sell, you know, who you are, your positioning, your branding. Maybe you're trying to sell a specific service or a, you know, product. Like, and that's what capitalism breeds. It breeds, you know, competition, and it breeds, you know, us versus them, and this kind of, you know, scarcity mindset, which we're all, I know I've been guilty of it often, and I try to be aware of it and kind of cultivate the opposite. When, just like anyone else, I need to make money as well.
Yeah, don't we all? So if you were writing a book called Equanimity for Dummies, what would be your top 2 or 3 things to take away from this?
I would say start and practice a meditation practice. Cultivate inner peace and clarity proactively. It's not like, oh my gosh, something bad happened. Let me go meditate. Okay, I feel better. No, that's not what it's about. We meditate so we can cultivate the behaviors and the mindsets that we want to have when the hard stuff happens. That's the inner work. Again, it doesn't have to be meditation. That's what I've chosen, the Buddhist kind of meditation mindfulness path. There are other ways that work for people. But that's what I would say is, if you have that practice and you've kind of been dabbling in it, like, concretize it. Do it. Because it's going to save you and it's going to save us. I would say, which that will help you do these other things, which is center on two things that are going to promote your own healing. Connection, true connection, whether it's with people you know well and love and maybe live with, or any interaction online, at the grocery store, in the community, in traffic. Center connection, however small, and resist the urge to other, to gossip, to dismiss, to ridicule, to mock. You can disagree, but really be, so the first agreement of the four agreements is be impeccable with your word. And the other thing related to the healing is the letting go. How can we have firm beliefs and conviction in those beliefs, but remove the charge? So that's a skill that people can and do cultivate, where you can say, whether you're a speaker, you're a coach, you're a podcast host, you're whatever your role is, you're a thought leader on LinkedIn, you can write with conviction and clarity and purpose without being an asshole. Because, yeah.
Don't be a dick. Yeah.
If you're an asshole, there are going to be people who already agree with you. They're like, yeah. But then what about the people who see you as an asshole and maybe would have agreed or been interested in what you're saying if you weren't an asshole? So it's really individual choice. So those are my insights.
Everything you're saying sounds to me, this is what emotional intelligence is built on. Yeah, the self-awareness, self-management. It's all about that. So obviously, emotional intelligence is built on Buddhist ideals and equanimity.
Well, it's emotional regulation. And so, you know, a common argument I've, you know, had or seen or been a part of or witnessed is, you know, don't tell me, you know, who are you, white guy, to tell me how to react to feel. Like, I'm not telling you how to. I'm inviting you to see things differently and to see the consequences of your behavior. Oh, well, is that more important than, you know, black people getting killed by the police? No, not at all. But what you're doing isn't stopping black people getting killed by the police, or pick your unjust cause that we all know is happening and needs to end. So it really is, as you said, it's EQ, it's self-awareness, it's emotional regulation. I guess there's a term kind of in the emotional sobriety, which I've come to kind of, I like that term.
Right? Joe, this has been an amazing conversation. We've been yakking away for an hour and a half, a bit in the green room, and we're probably overrun on this episode. I could keep chatting to you all day. In fact, I'm tempted to jump on a plane, come to Oakland, whatever. Go to that fish restaurant I mentioned earlier that I went to with HR West. But and I'd love to hire another car and go up to the wetlands and all the redwood forests and things like that, and just chill out for a day. So yeah,
you're welcome anytime.
Superb. So how can people get hold of you? You mentioned you don't have a huge amount of social media. So that what's the best way of tracking you down?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn, just Jared Carroll, JaredKarol. You can search for me on LinkedIn. Also, the co-founder with my partner, Cornell, Three Arrows Coaching, LLC. There's another one or two Three Arrows Coaching on LinkedIn. So if you are looking for that on LinkedIn, type in the LLC, you'll find us. Our program, our coaching program, is called the Three Arrows of Life. So just threearrowsoflife.com. And you'll get to learn a little bit more about that program and how to be part of it if this is something that you're interested in. Also, we didn't talk about this. I think we mentioned it before we started recording, but I'm also a vinyl DJ. So if you are in the Bay Area and you're looking for, you know, private parties or, you know, corporate events, you can go to djmaju.com, M-A-J-U, D-J-M-A-J-U.com. and learn about the vinyl DJing offerings there.
And fascinating.
I think that's it.
Brilliant, brilliant. So if you do connect with Jared and he does send you an outreach on LinkedIn, rather than just shoot him down, invite him on your own podcast and have a good chat, because it's been absolutely fascinating. And I've found a friend from 4,500 miles away, and it's been fantastic. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
The feeling is mutual. Thank you. Glad to be here.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.